Well, appreciate the attendance of everyone this evening. I really enjoyed the study. Maybe more so than usual. I don't know. For some reason, I kind of got into the geography a little bit. I was telling Austin about that. Some pretty neat things going on here.
I wanted to start here because... Oh, turn it on. Yeah. So this top map, again, the pass, we're talking about this right here between Michmash and Geba, this pass. And then we got this place. Gibeah is going to be important. We're going to notice Gibeah, Beth Aven, and I think it's important. Oh, here's another one we're going to notice in our study. So we finished up here, remember, chapter 13. These Philistines were dispersing. They were going out, and they were going to continue to attack. So that's kind of, that's part of what's happening here. There's a big group of them right here. So this view here I really liked with the topography, but it's a little confusing because this view here is looking from the east. It's looking from the east, and this would be east over here, going this way. It's looking that way. And this is, here's Michmash and here's Geba again. And so this pass is this area between. And I had some other pictures. This is really rugged ground. This is, we might think like the Badlands of South Dakota. I was thinking about this earlier. We might think like the Badlands of South Dakota. Much worse than this. Tall, taller, big rugged country. And you know, it's interesting that the Bible from time to time gives us insight where geography can help us understand and make an impression on us, as it does in this study. And you know, sometimes the geography is the plains. And we saw how the Lord drenched the plains and the chariot wheels bogged down, and Israel was able to win, and the geography became important with the rain. Again, to help us visualize the narrative better. And in this instance, it helps us see because Saul is down here with the high priest and 600 of his men. He's actually north of that a little bit. And I in my reading, I found out that between the pass and Gibeah was like a one-hour march. So you kind of get an idea of the distance a little bit. We're going to see some neat things tonight. I'm going to do a little spoiler here. Verse 16 tells us that Saul's watchmen could look and see the Philistine army. You know, again, Saul's guys are down here. Saul and his 600 are down here, but they could still see up here. So they're back off this way, and they're able to see. No, I got it backwards. They're down here at Gibeah, and they're able to see up toward Michmash and be able to see the army melting away, the army of the Philistines. Verse 15 is pretty neat. Maybe because they're, I don't really know, 5 miles, 10 miles tops. Maybe they were able to feel this trembling that's talked about in verse 15. And then verse 19. We definitely know Saul was able to hear the armies of the army of the Philistine in battle with itself in verse 19. So there's a lot. There's some really neat stuff here. Probably need to get going. I need to be reminded where we were.
Cole was last.
Okay, Austin. Let's see. Oh, and then I found this cool map. I thought that was pretty neat. Kind of giving you some of the... and that's a beehive. Not a beehive. That's a bee. Yeah, I guess it would be a beehive. But that's where all that's what they would see. And I tried to do a little searching, you know, Middle East beehives, and they would hang down from tree limbs and stuff like that. So they really would drip to the ground with honey coming out of the comb. So I thought that was really neat. I mean, like I can't remember what they call big slabs of this stuff, and they could peel it off the tree after they got through all the bees. Okay. Question number one. Got a bunch of verses in there. Don't worry about trying to read it. Austin, if you like, why did Jonathan not tell anyone where he was going? Who was the high priest at that time? What was the outcome of Jonathan's raid?
Okay, So that beehive is my worst nightmare, by the way. That is terrifying. Very real. So why doesn't Jonathan tell anybody where he's going? I don't know, to be honest with you. You know, I kind of struggle trying to think of an answer or think of a motive, because there's not really a good motive for him not to tell anybody, I guess, outside of he wanted to do it and maybe someone else didn't want him to do it. Maybe Saul was opposed. I think we can see a little bit later over in verse 29 where Jonathan kind of speaks out against Saul's handling of this oath. Talks about how he troubles
the land.
Yeah, he troubles the land. And I can't help but wonder if maybe that's a frustration that kind of boils over that started earlier. From chapter 13, it was Jonathan that attacks the garrison there, right? And initiates some of this, and then it's Saul that's hanging back. So maybe Saul wanted him to do that in 13. Maybe he didn't want him to do it here. I don't know exactly what his motivation was, but those were some of the options I thought may have been. The high priest, or at least the Lord's priest in Shiloh, we kind of assume that's the high priest, I guess. Ahijah, or I think it's his name is also Ahimelech.
I think I saw that too.
Yeah, a little bit later, because he's described as the son of the same person. And Saul, of course, eventually kills him and a whole bunch of other priests because they are on David's side, or he assumes that they are. It's interesting that we get this little mention. It takes us all the way back to earlier in the book, because Ahijah, Ahimelech, is the son of Ahitub, which is Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas. We got this whole section about how Ichabod came into the world and kind of how depressing it really was for so many people. So we would have to assume that either Ahijah is Ichabod's, or Ahitub is Ichabod's half-brother, or he's his older brother. I wasn't sure which one was more likely. It's probably his older brother, but I don't know. But anyway, that's how it snakes down from all the way from Eli. And I think when Saul ends up killing him later on down the road, it's probably a fulfillment of that prophecy against the house of Eli. Mm-hmm. So there's still a little remnant of the house of Eli hanging on here. How this all transpires is very interesting, of course. Him and his armor bearer go up. He asks his armor bearer, hey, why don't you come up with me? Maybe, I love verse 6, maybe either the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. It's a great vote of confidence there in the Lord. Armor bearer, of course, is right with him. And they say, okay, this is going to be our test. We'll have this saying. If they answer this way, then we'll go. If they don't answer, we'll head on out of here. And they answer the right way. Look, the Hebrews are coming up out of the holes. Come up to us. We're gonna show you something.
Show you something.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, all right. We got something to show you too. And they end up killing about 20 of them there. It's interesting. It talks about, verse 4 talks about the terrain there. I really enjoyed your maps there. The sharp rock on one side and all that, which is central to what's going on here in this particular event.
Yeah. Anyone else on this first question? Yeah, Trace.
Well, the first part of the question, kind of back to chapter 13, where it says, verse 3, Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Gibeah, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all Israel heard it and said that Saul had attacked the garrison. So it kind of made me think that maybe Saul took his son's thunder a little bit. And Jonathan's like, you know what? I'm going to go do this with my armor bearer, you know, not tell anybody. And he also obviously had faith that God would get him through. So I thought that was
cool. Yeah. Anyone ever heard the expression, I ask for forgiveness, not for permission? That's what kind of came to mind here. I kind of thought Jonathan didn't want to give Saul a chance to tell him no. You're down there at Gibeah sitting under a pomegranate tree. I'm going to go do something. That's kind of how I felt about it. Anyone else? Yeah, Bart?
Yeah, Jonathan, I think, is just remarkable. Leviticus 26 talks about how 10 of you will chase 100 and 100 will chase 1,000 along those lines. And I think Jonathan knows what Moses and the Torah promised, and so he's acting on that. And then it struck me how David mimics Jonathan. You read it a minute ago and mentioned how he says, God can save with few. How's he worded back on the previous? God can save with few or many.
Verse 6,
yeah. Nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. And remember what David says some years later when he goes against Goliath. He says, the Lord does not save with sword and spear. The battle is the Lord's. And so, Jonathan's example lived on after he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
Influenced David.
Yeah, I want to try to keep moving, but I got several different little insights here I want to point out. You know, this idea of this gap, this pass. I Google searched, or not Google searched, I got on my Blue Letter Bible and did a word search on that pass in this verse. And then turn around and looked at all the other Bible translations, or about 20 Bible translations. This one here, wrong one. Shoot. Okay. This one right here, this ridge. I don't know why New King James Version did ridge. I think I saw one other ridge in about 18 passages. But think about passes getting through mountains. That's what we're talking about here. This is what this is about. And Mizpah was a key strategic place for the Philistines because then they could monitor the traffic in that valley. Started with a Z. I can't remember how to pronounce it. Let alone do it. But this was I thought insightful. It's a pass, not a ridge. Think about this. Our current church lot is 0.97 acres or something. So half of this, maybe draw a line, you know what, maybe about right here. Think about the back lot, maybe the back of the building. Draw a line. Half of that, I got 22 guys having a gladiator style battle with an armor bearer shield and a sword and 20 Philistine warriors. I mean, battle, gladiators probably. So this was quite an event, an area. Hey, here you go, Bart. I was looking for that. Nothing restrains the Lord. Yep. And here's how you restrain the Lord. By unbelief. That's how you restrain the Lord. Yeah, and if God is with us, who can be against us? And Bart, don't you love the army bearer? Do what's in your heart. I'm with you. Yeah, okay. Let's see. Question number two, Hunter, if you're up for it. What did Saul's watchman see? Why did Saul call for the Ark of the Covenant? And how did the Lord save Israel that day? Verses 16 through 23.
Yeah. So, as far as what Saul's watchman or his scouts saw, they see this very interesting sight of sort of pandemonium and confusion, and things are breaking down. Obviously divine intervention. Maybe it kind of started with Jonathan going up there, and maybe he kind of started. But who knows? For whatever reason, everyone's going to the camp of Philistines is sort of losing it, and they're confused. And as we get down to the later verses, they start attacking each other, and there's presumably a lot of dead Philistines on the ground. And so they see this, I guess before it gets to that point later in 20-22, those verses, Saul calls for the ark. I saw some commentators seem like they were thinking maybe it was more the ephod than the ark, but regardless, he calls for one of those items to inquire of God. Understandably, this weird situation going on, what should I do, what should we do? Sort of characteristic of Saul, at least now, looking at the last chapter, he inquires, but he doesn't get an answer, and he just kind of impulsively moves forward. At least there's no answer recorded here. You can see that in verse 19 when he says to the priest, withdraw your hand. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really get an answer. He seems to just be antsy to figure out what's going on. So he leaves. They go check out the scene, and it seems to be pretty drastic. And yeah, so it's pretty much already answered. So the Lord saves Israel via this mass confusion pandemonium.
Yeah, no, I think that's a whole lot of what's going on here. Anyone else got anything to add here? Mark?
Yeah, I agree with what Hunter said. I do think it's the ephod that is being referred to here. The Septuagint has ephod. Many of the English translations put ephod in this place. And the reason why is because we know the ark is down in Kirjath-Jearim, where it stays until David returns it, and we have the whole Uzzah incident. And so it doesn't make any sense that Saul would call for the ark. Also, you didn't use the ark to know the Lord's will. You used the ephod to know the Lord's will. And it's mentioned previously when we talked about who the high priest was. It even says he was wearing the ephod.
It's pointed out early in chapter 14, and we see it coming into play.
So he has the ephod with him, and Saul says, come and help me divine what God thinks we should do. And it even says, one of the commentators said, where it says 19, withdraw your hand.
Yeah, yeah.
The high priest, according to this commentator, would put his hand over the Urim and the Thummim. They would ask God the question, and then they would withdraw their hand, and the stones would give them the answer.
Yes, no answer.
Yes or no answer. And so apparently God said yes in this particular situation, and so that's why that went to that. So I think that makes much more sense than thinking that somebody had to go get the ark down in Kirjath. This is a battle. You know, it's going to take time to, you know, they, and of course, how do you bring the ark without the Levites and all the people that you need to, you know, and it takes a day and whatever. This happens immediately, so it's got to be the ark.
Yeah. I think, again, looking from Gibeah, they're able to see the army melting away off the hillside, probably. Because they're going to have to be high elevation to be able to see. And so then, once that starts, Saul, get your hand out. Let's go. We need to go. So I don't think he heard. I don't think he heard from the Lord. I don't know. We don't really know. We don't know if he did or not, but he took off the fight. And he saw the confusion that was going on, that the Lord had created this confusion to where they were fighting with each other. And what a story. Yeah, there's still on my notes. Anything else on question number two? This whole asking for the ephod, the ark, was Saul truly sincere about that ask, or was he just trying to appear righteous? We don't know. You know, we can speculate all we want. Oh, and I did like the saving of Israel that day by supporting Jonathan's initial work, verse 14, causing confusion in the camp of the Philistines, verse 20, and giving courage to the Israelite. Think about it. The Israelite deserters, the hiders, and even the mercenaries that were maybe Israelites fighting for the Philistines. That was normal. They did that. You know, all these people are changing heart here at the end of this group of verses. All right.
Just briefly, it's also interesting. This is kind of the first miracle of Saul's reign, right? They do have the battle against...
miracle. Is it Jonathan's fight was a miracle? Is that what you're...
Well, and the fact that the Lord saved Israel. That type of language.
Right.
This is kind of the first time it's used in description of Saul. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of significant too. Maybe the first one that they've seen since Samuel, all the way back in his day also.
Okay, let's keep moving. I'm talking too much. Okay, question number three, Dennis, if you're up for it. Why did Saul issue this curse about eating food? What did Jonathan say when he was told about the curse? How did the curse of Saul cause the people to sin? Why did Saul build an altar after the events of the previous chapter?
You spent a little time on this.
We don't have much left.
I don't know why did Saul issue this curse about eating food. I'm thinking that it was done impulsively, that maybe to appear heroic or more in charge and kingly, but it had disastrous side effects, of which men were too tired or weak to fight effectively. And also the men ate meat containing blood, which was against God's law, causing them to sin, corrupt them to sin, and he almost killed his son. So I think it was an impulsive thing that he did. I don't know exactly why. Second, B, why did Jonathan say it? About the curse? Well, in so many words, just my words, my father is making some unthought out decisions that are causing no harm to good. Well, what I got out of that. C, how did the curse cause people to sin? We've already touched on that. They were ravenous. They ate meat with the blood in it, still in it, violating God's law in Leviticus 17, verse 10. The last part of it, why did Saul build an altar? After previous, that's the previous chapter. Seems that Saul had been king for several years. And now, only now, he gets getting around to building an altar to the Lord. It seems as though I see his method of operation is to do things his own way, and only when they don't work out or he gets pressured, and he considers God.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah, quite a bit of speculation in this question. Yeah. Some things kind of hard for us to get to. Anyone else? Question number three.
I've got some stuff here. This is pretty similar. What Saul blurted out is pretty similar to what Jezebel said, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then my father's troubled the land.
Let's see. I was wondering if Saul wanted to focus on him. You know, we've talked about that from time to time. I take vengeance on my enemies, verse 24. You know, maybe he was trying to even this. I'm king. I'll even kill my son if he disobeys my law, and an opportunity for him to make that impression.
Yeah, Trace mentioned it. We read he takes credit for Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that he did, but the wording of it.
And Saul's sense of authority is wrong. Saul did not have the authority to proclaim a curse, and Saul is not the spiritual leader of Israel. That's Samuel. Samuel could proclaim a curse with God's direction, but Saul did not have that authority. And that is slide number 7. Yeah, and cooking the or eating the uncooked meat, and you know, I'd like to give Saul the possibility that this altar that he built was a place of slaughter. You know, in Arabic, altar means a place of slaughter in Arabic. So I kind of wondered if maybe he was just because he got torched pretty good in 13. For offering a sacrifice. So I'm thinking, bring him here and we're going to slaughter him here. And that way, maybe a place to, you know, it was still an altar, but it was for the physical needs, the slaughter, I think. I think he learned his lesson about spiritually offering. Anyone else? Okay. Number 4, Grant, if you'd like. Why did Saul think there was sin in the camp? Had Jonathan really committed a sin? Why did the people save Jonathan from his father?
The first one there, why did Saul think that there was sin in the camp? I think it fairly clearly points this out in verse 37. It says, so Saul asked counsel of God, shall I go down to the Philistines? Will he deliver them into my hand? But he did not answer him that day. I think Saul is used to hearing a very quick answer, like the ephod with him asking the answer to the question, but there was no answer this time. So there was probably a quick answer before.
And Bart mentioned it also. I'm not sure if you know, I think we're assuming he got an answer when he told the priest to withdraw his hand and Saul left. I'm not sure we know if he got an answer or not.
I think it's kind of implies that yes, it was likely an answer previously, because here it says that he hasn't heard about it that day, but he did not answer him that day.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he was expecting an answer.
Mm-hmm.
So
he definitely wasn't patient, was he?
No, he wasn't. He was shut several times throughout
But yeah, that's why he didn't get an answer to your question. So I thought there were probably some that can't. So second question, had Jonathan really committed a sin? Since Jonathan hadn't heard the proclamation, the oath that he had to be made, I don't think he would necessarily to be held by it. So I'd say probably no, but Jonathan at the very end says, yeah, you must put me to death. And Jonathan's like saying, yeah, this is what you said. This is how it should be. You made this oath. This is how it should be. So Jonathan, after he found out what it was, said that, yes, that's probably what should happen. So I'm kind of out of that one. Saying, so part of me says yes, part of me says no. So I don't know actually exactly how. And then the last question there, the third one. Why did the people save Jonathan from his father? The people saw Jonathan's actions. People saw, okay, Jonathan's the one who's stepping up. He's the one who God is delivering the Philistines into his hand. So the people are like, you don't want to do this, Saul. This is actually a bad decision to make. And so they were putting their faith in what they were presuming to be the next king after Saul's. But Saul dies and Jonathan dies.
I like the phrase, not one hair of his head shall be harmed, or something like that. Anyone else? Question number four. Austin?
So, I'm with Grant there on question B. Did Jonathan really commit a sin? It doesn't seem like he did, but what I think is happening here is that Saul invoked the name of the Lord. And I think that's why, of course, the Urim and Thummim is being referenced here. And why God is getting answers on that as to who committed the sin in the camp, right?
Yeah, right.
So I think it's because he makes this rash oath, as you pointed out, that he didn't have the authority to do. That wasn't his job,
right?
But he takes it upon himself. He invokes the Lord, so the Lord gets involved. That's my thought. I don't know if that's exactly what's going on here, but that would explain why God answers. It would explain why Jonathan is okay with the outcome, seemingly, or is willing to submit to the outcome.
Yeah, look at what Josephus said. Kaufman quoted Josephus about Jonathan. I do not desire you, Father, to spare me. Death will be to me very acceptable when it proceeds from thy piety and after a glorious victory, for it is the greatest consolation to me that I leave the Hebrews victorious over the Philistines. That's what Josephus says, Jonathan said. Probably handed down through eons of time. Anyone else? Question number four. Okay, question B. Here's my take on question B. Is it a sin to eat honey? No. Saul made this curse, took an oath, created an oath. He made it to where no one was supposed to eat honey. Jonathan didn't know about it. This is my analogy. If we think about the laws of the land, whether we know about the law or not, if we violate it and get caught, we're going to pay the price. So does that same thing apply in this kind of situation, Jonathan not knowing? Personally, I don't think it does, but just something to ponder. Anyone else on? Oh, Bart.
Yeah, real great discussion. I just have one thought, and this is sort of looking for a metaphor. You know, I think we all can agree that Saul is a bad leader. Honey often represents the word of God. And it sounds like a miraculous event, right? That there's enough, and maybe not, but, you know, hundreds, thousands of soldiers having enough honey on the ground to eat. And then Saul saying, don't eat that. And it's kind of interesting that in a way, it's like he's holding back the word of God from his people. So he's being a poor leader. Like, you know, the Bible often talks about elders or leaders in the church who hurt the people. Hurt the flock, and it's, in a way, Saul is sort of a prototype. He's hurting his own flock.
I like the honey analogy. Anyone else? Question number four. All right. Number five, Trace, if you'd like it. What was Saul's reign characterized by, according to these verses? Are there any noteworthy elements of the list of Saul's family tree here?
So for part A. He is characterized here, it seems like, somewhat at the beginning of these verses and kind of at the end of these verses. So, verse 47 says, so Saul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side. And then you have, in 52, it says, Now there was fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him for himself. So it's almost like, I don't know what to characterize that to, but it kind of like he led with his pride. He wanted to glorify himself. And so he wanted everyone to see him as the valiant, you know. And he didn't want to give God the praise that he deserved. Kind of what I saw.
There's several different times I think Saul demonstrates jealousy.
Yes, jealousy. And trying to usurp God, essentially, or Samuel. And for B, are there any noteworthy elements to the list of Saul's family right here? I'm going to pass on that part.
Okay. Anyone else? Question number 5. Levi.
I like, it's difficult, especially in this for me, is like we like to categorize, or at least we like to like put personalities to find the characters when the Bible's vague. And it's kind of hard, it's so difficult with Saul, like trying to picture him. We've already done that a bunch, studying for Samuel, speculating what type of person Saul is. But I just think it's interesting that right after his big sin, he's doing all his conquests and succeeding. I just think that's interesting. I don't know if it's, I think Trace mentioned anger and, you know, just wanting to be the best, but I just think it's interesting how the Bible talks about it in this way after he committed that sin. And then for the second part, I think the big guy that is important that was mentioned here is Abner, because he's the commander of Saul's army, and he commands the armies, and he's kind of like juxtaposed to Joab later on when David comes, mm-hmm. and is anointed as king, who's David's commander. Abner shows up a lot more because he's the guy who brings David in front of the king when he slays Goliath, in front of Saul when he slays Goliath. And then also he's the one once Saul dies to take one of Saul's sons. And, he doesn't accept the Lord's anointed. He doesn't accept David as king, so he shows up
Ishbosheth. Anyone else? Question number 5.
Yeah, really quick. We mentioned in our study how Saul here is kind of the opposite of Christ, in a sense. Just going off of the expectation of the Israelites, right, at the time, especially Peter, you know, wanting this conquering king, this conquering Messiah to come in and go to war with all these, you know, the Romans, all these oppressors, and really, you know, take charge and just war against them. And that's all Saul does, you know, it says in that verse. You know, all, let's see, at the very end, what does it say there, the exact verse?
Let's see. Well, up here at the front. Right up here, fought against all these guys.
On every side against Moab.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's his legacy, you know. He's being, if you want to say, a warmonger, right? Against the enemies of the Philistines. Whereas the true Messiah, one that, you know, is prophesied, obviously doesn't do that. So just an interesting contrast.
Yeah, right? Yeah, very good. I appreciate that. Complete opposite. You're right. Anyone else? Austin?
Briefly, there's also a contrast with Samuel also, because Samuel was, it was peace in his day. He made peace for a very long time.
Good.
And now Saul completely reversed that.
Yeah.
The people got exactly what they wanted. They wanted a king to lead them in battle.
That's right. And
they got a lot of
and this king's taking their valiant men, or their strong and valiant men, he's taking them for his own, build his own army, which was told this is going to happen. It's happening. Good stuff. I had something else to mention. Verse 46. Got away from us on question number 4. Verse 46. Then Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Now, I'd like a little bit of help, because I'm not sure if Saul is returning from his request to pursue them at night, or if this is just a general return. Like everything's settling down now. Any thoughts, you guys? Anybody? Okay.
I was kind of wondering about that. If it, yeah, Bart.
I think it means that he doesn't succeed in completely eliminating the threat. Even Jonathan has said that if the people had eaten the honey, then they would have succeeded more.
Yes.
And so the Philistines continue to be a problem all the way to the time of David. David fights against the Philistines.
Yep.
In fact, Goliath, right?
Yep.
And so Saul, in a sense, while it does say he fights these other enemies, he fails in completely subduing the Philistines, and it takes David to actually do it.
Kaufman, I think it was, pointed out that when Israel sinned against God and God made them wander in the wilderness for 40 more years, he drew the comparison between Israel wandering in the wilderness for 40 years to Saul's reign of 40 years. That they were both not allowed to shine, if you will. There's some history during that 40 years, but not very much. Same way with Saul. There's some history of some of his battles, but he was a warrior for 40 years. I don't know how many fights that would be, but it's almost like when they disobeyed God and God took their blessings away from them, you're done. I'm not going to record that much information about you moving forward. So that's just another observation. Any other closing comments? Appreciate everyone's participation and hope you found it interesting, an interesting study.